It was in November 1978 that the world awoke to the shocking story that over 900, not, as I said before, 9,000, 900 people had committed suicide or been murdered in the Jonestown commune in Guyana under the leadership of the charismatic Jim Jones. I remember it well. It was as unfathomable then as it is now, almost beyond belief that someone could convince that number of people to commit revolutionary suicide, as he called it. What started out as a religious cult committed to black and white integration somehow morphed into something incredibly deadly. Our next guest has spent a long time deep in the archives to create a work of historical fiction telling the story not so much about the charismatic Jim Jones, but from the perspective of a few characters close to him, in particular the woman who was his mistress and second in command. Laura Elizabeth Woollett is the author of this riveting novel, Beautiful Revolutionary, which is published by Scribe, and she joins me now from Melbourne. Welcome to Late Night Live, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
So, Laura, you researched Jim Jones and the Jonestown Massacre for over 2 years for your book. This is a huge story, isn't it? Spanning decades, different locations, different characters. Perhaps we can begin by just getting you to remind us of the basics of this history.
Of course. Well, really, People's Temple, Jim Jones's church, began in 1950s Indiana, which was a very racist place. It was, pre-integration, so businesses and so forth were all segregated at the time. And he started this church, which was really totally different to anything else that was happening at the time, where black and white people were encouraged to worship together. And it was very controversial, but he gained quite a large following at the time and did a lot locally within Indiana in terms of integrating local businesses and restaurants and that sort of thing. But in the early 1960s, he read an article in Esquire magazine, which was called Nine Places to Hide from the Nuclear Bomb. There was a lot of Cold War panic at the time, and he read this article and started thinking about places to relocate his church. And first he looked in Brazil and moved his family to Brazil for a while and spent a couple of years there. But then while he was there, his church kind of diminished in size and only his truest followers, you could say, remained. But that didn't work out, and he ended up relocating his congregation, who had diminished from about 2,000 people to about 80 people, to Northern California. And by this time, it was the mid-1960s, and a lot was happening in terms of, social revolution in a general sense. There was anti-Vietnam protests going on, and there was a big movement towards racial equality. It was more of an accepted idea. And he began to attract people, a younger congregation, who were really sympathetic to those ideas. And during that time, his church grew massively, and they ended up relocating from rural Northern California to San Francisco. And by that time, Jones had a lot of connections within San Francisco politics. He was quite chummy with George Moscone, who was the mayor of San Francisco in 1976, and also Harvey Milk, who's quite a well-known figure. But with the, increase in publicity and becoming more notorious, he also attracted more attention, and he was being looked at more critically, and people began to see, the problems within his church and to report on, things that were going on in terms of stealing money from his members. And
his church had started to take on cult-like characteristics by this stage?
It really had. you know, they began as quite a peace-loving movement, and but by that time, and it wasn't, you know, known to outsiders, but punishments were integrated for people who were, you know, disobeying rules within the church and that sort of thing. It wasn't uncommon for members to be working 20 hours a day and sleeping very little, and just, you know, really discouraged from thinking for themselves.
Mm. And so they eventually moved to Guyana, where there was basically an attempt to create some sort of quasi-socialist paradise there, really, wasn't there?
Yeah, and Jonestown was actually originally only meant to be for about 500 people. It was supposed to be quite a small agricultural community. But as Jones attracted negative publicity, he was just like, I'm going to move everyone down there with me. And the infrastructure really wasn't built to support that many people. And basically overnight, they went from having a population of, you know, a couple of hundred to over 1,000 people.
Mm.
And so he basically moved everyone there so he could have more control and isolate his congregation from outside influences.
And I think we know how the story ends in November 1978, don't we, with more than 900 people dying in that mass suicide, mass murder, however you want to describe it, including more than 300 people. What's interesting, though, that's the kind of backstory. You decided to write your book based on the lives of Carolyn and Larry Layton, although in your book you rename them Evelyn and Lenny. Tell us about how they came across Jim Jones and the People's Temple.
Well, they were really representative of the second wave of People's Temple, the younger Californian progressive membership. They were both children of the post-war baby boom. They were both from middle-class, upper-middle-class families. And Carolyn actually was the daughter of a Methodist minister and came from a family who were very progressive and very had similar values to People's Temple in the sense that they believed in practicing what they preached and helping their fellow man. So she was really drawn to the socialist and egalitarian aspects of People's Temple. It really appealed to her. And Larry, again, was from quite a wealthy Californian family. He was a pacifist and a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War at the time that he joined People's Temple. Mm. Yeah, so they were, you know, drawn to the politics more than the religious aspects.
But it wasn't long before Carolyn became Jim Jones' lover, and it was the start of a very long and very intense relationship, wasn't it? What do you think drew Carolyn toward Jim Jones?
Well, I think she was drawn to his values initially, but I think also she was a person who had never been very happy in her relationships with men. She actually got together with Larry on the rebound from another engagement. So I think that marriage wouldn't have lasted anyway, but Jim Jones was just there and kind of manipulated the breakup of this marriage. He was very, you know, he set his sights on her. And
you write about his voice drawing her in.
Yeah, he was definitely charismatic in the sense that he was very good at speaking and keeping the attention of his congregation.
And she fell madly in love pretty much from the beginning?
Well, that's debatable. I think it was actually a relationship which was manufactured in some ways by him breaking up her marriage, and who knows, really? It's the sort of thing that can't really be commented on. In my book, definitely, it is more of a... there's a lot of chemistry between them. But, yeah, I do think there was a lot of manipulation at the same time.
And do you know what Jim Jones' wife thought of Carolyn Layton? Because they never divorced, despite Jones' unfaithfulness, not just with Carolyn, I should add, but with many people, many women and men in the cult.
Yeah, Marceline Jones, she was actually a very well-loved figure within People's Temple. And Jones encouraged the congregation to refer to him as father and to his wife, Marceline, as mother. So she represented this kind of almost Virgin Mary sort of figure. She was a, you know, this nurturing female mother figure. And I think because she was so well loved, Jones and Carolyn as well, who was very invested in keeping People's Temple together and making it as big as it could be, they managed to keep his wife within the church because that was seen as a strategic movement. And actually, it's said that a lot of people probably would have left the church if she was no longer part of it, because she was, the wife was very good at softening Jim Jones and, you know, making some of his unreasonable demands seem reasonable, because she was this really approachable sort of person.
Mm. Do you think that Jim Jones was ever really a deeply religious man, a Christian man, or was he using religion essentially to draw people in?
Well, from childhood, Jim Jones was actually fascinated with religion. It was said that he was fascinated with religion and death from an early age. And as a young child, he would actually hold funerals for animals that he found, dead animals. And he also, as a young child, he was quite neglected, and his parents didn't give him a lot of attention. But he had a neighbour who was part of the Pentecostal church, you know, the very faith-healing sort of church that was around at the time. So he was exposed to the church through this neighbour and was really captivated by it, and associated it with feelings of love and feelings of acceptance. But whether that means he was religious per se is debatable.
Is it possible to pinpoint exactly when this became a fully blown kind of religious cult that had morphed into something, you know, uniquely awful?
Well, speaking to survivors, I mean, a lot of them object to it being called a cult because they believed it was a social movement and it was about politics more than religion. But definitely in popular consciousness, when we think of cults, Jonestown is what we think of, and I think it's impossible to separate it from, you know, those aspects, no matter how good their intentions were. But yeah, I think, you know, you can look at it in a couple of different ways: as a movement which was about social equality, but you can also look at it as a movement with a leader who was power hungry and who exploited people and manipulated people and got them to give up their life savings and broke up relationships and separated people from their families. And that really happened gradually. It's kind of the, you know, frog in boiling water situation. People didn't necessarily know when it started getting bad, but they were already in too deep.
And as far as Carolyn is concerned, she stayed loyal to Jim until the very end, as far as we know?
Yeah, and there's actually a document which, it's undated, but it was probably written a couple of months before the Jonestown Massacre, called An Analysis of Future Prospects, in which she actually discusses revolutionary suicide as a possible outcome, I guess, or, you know, answer to problems that the community was facing. You know, she actually discusses, you know, we can fight for what we believe in, or we can commit revolutionary suicide, or we can do something else. But she was definitely someone who was privy to Jones's decisions and
witnessed him as he became increasingly manic and paranoid. Did you come to some understanding of what made her continue to be loyal until the end?
It's a difficult thing, because I think, you know, there's always going to be a lot of mystery associated with her. And I even after studying her for such a long time, I didn't have the answers to all those questions. But I do think when you've invested your life in something and, you know, you see something as the answer to all your ideals, and then seeing it go bad, you'll wonder what you do next and what kind of meaning you have in your life.
You have a lot invested in it, don't you?
Yeah.
Mm. Laura, it's been terrific talking to you. Thank you. It's a fascinating story. Thank you for being our guest on Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Elizabeth Woollett, author of Beautiful Revolutionary, published by Scribe.